The world of 911 emergency dispatching is brutally diverse. One minute you can be talking with someone about parking violations.
What's the process we are to take to have people towed? Because it's actually delaying the mail.
And then all hell can break loose. Then the rest of the day is crazy. We could have murders.
Hill County 911, what's your emergency?
I just killed my children.
Home invasions.
He's in my house.
I shot him.
You shot him?
He was coming up towards me and I shot him.
Natural disasters.
Tornado came through and got us. I'm buried under a bomb to roll my life.
Even bombings. My show, Music City 911, will put you in the dispatcher's chair, put you ear to ear with the callers and responders, and keep you on edge from start to finish. I hope to both educate and entertain, as I'm a 911 dispatcher with over 20 years experience. And just like dispatching, every episode is different from the last. Music City 911. Real 911 calls, real 911 dispatchers. Available to listen to on any podcast app.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price.
This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
This is A Million Other Choices, and I am your host, Kim. I know that most of you are here for the lack of blah blah blah, but today I have some etc. etc. just to mention. None of this is a you problem, but I'm just giving you all a heads up about it. I'm a little behind in my recording schedule because, well, life. I'm Generation X, so between parents in their late 70s, early 80s, and kids near but not yet at the launching stage, things are a little bit busy, and now it's smoky around here because of climate change, and I'm hacking up a lung half the time, so editing takes a lot longer, and I can't get stressed out and go all mom rage like I normally would because stupid crones. So anyways, I'm doing my best to stay on track and get my episodes written and recorded and edited in time, but I also don't want to slack on my attention to detail and get sloppy about things, so you just kind of have to bear with me. I did take the last week of May off of my regular job, so I'm hoping that I can take that time and get my poop in a group and get with the program a little bit better. Anywho, that's my blah 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 this week. I appreciate your continued support and staying with me while I get my shit together. I have an unsolved one for you today, but if you ask me, which you didn't, but I'm telling you anyways, it's pretty much solved. There's just no justice. This is the disappearance of Dylan Koshman. Dylan was your very normal, very average young man, born on April 11th, 1987 in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, which again, for those of you not in Canada, is in fact a real place. There are actually two theories on how it got its name. Some say it's because the creek around the city resembles, well, a moose's jaw, and others, and probably the more accurate, is that it comes from the Cree word Mooska, which means warm breezes. I actually really like Moose Jaw. It's a nice little town with an interesting history, and if you visit it, do the tunnel tours. Now, this story doesn't take place in Moose Jaw, but the small population of about 33,000 people is probably important in a way to Dylan's story, who, after high school, decided to leave his mom and dad and younger sister Tara and brother Derek and move to Edmonton to figure out what he wanted to do in his life. His first cousins, 30-year-old Colin DeMasson and 23-year-old Nick Kosman, were living in Edmonton and had a room to rent in their rented house in the area of town of Steinhauser, which is on the south end and very close to 34th Avenue and Calgary Trail, which are major thoroughfares. And the move made sense at the time to go out there and live with family and get work, which he did. He managed to settle in as an apprentice pipe fitter, which, although considered manual labor, is a pretty good job paying about $30 to $40 an hour, especially for a 21-year-old. And soon after he moved out, he met a pretty blonde lady named Erin Hoff while out one night at the pubs that lined White Avenue. Erin was attending college and was from Edmonton. And I just want to lay the scene a little bit for you if you aren't that familiar with the Edmonton area. Edmonton is the capital city of Alberta, which no one really probably cares about that part. Its population is just over 1 million people, which makes it one of our larger cities in Canada. Yes, we are, but a wee nation, at least in population. And it's situated pretty much right smack in the middle of our province, which is shaped much like a slightly skewed triangle that someone took a bite out of the bottom of it. And the house that the DeMasson brothers were renting was at 10404 33rd Avenue. The house itself is just a brown stucco bungalow with a driveway leading to a single detached garage in the back. Now, the back of the house, which is probably the part we are later most interested in, would have the detached garage to the left of the house a little bit, and then a grass yard surrounded by a fence with a gate, and then behind the gate, rather than like a back alley, because this particular stretch of road that the house is on backs onto 34th Avenue and Calgary Trail. So there would be green space with trees and kind of like a park that leads to the major thoroughfares. So don't let the term trail fool you. If you aren't from around these parts, what Americans call freeways, we call trails. So Deerfoot Trail, Edmonton Trail, etc. These are major roadways, usually with about three lanes of traffic in each direction, with not many intersections, just like exits that you exit off of. And on the other side of this particular stretch of Calgary Trail that goes along behind the houses, there are big box type stores all along connected by a giant parking lot. There's a Save on Foods, an Indigo, which I don't think exists anymore, a bank, and then further down is a Denny's and a 7-Eleven, which, as I think most of us know, are open 24 hours. Okay, so the scene is set. In the weeks leading up to the Thanksgiving weekend when Dylan was 21, which is for some reason a time when I think this is the third story now that I have done of a person going missing over the Thanksgiving weekend. In 2008, Colin and Nick were getting a bit irritated with Dylan because Erin, his girlfriend, was pretty much living there. And as the story goes, they started to feel like if she's there all the time, maybe she should be chipping in on rent. And so Erin remembers around that time that Dylan talked about moving out and getting his own place. Now, this was tension, not homicidal maniac type stuff. But we're talking about three youngish men here, so there was probably arguments and tough talk between them in the week leading up to the Thanksgiving weekend. So for that weekend, Dylan invited his other cousin Cameron, who was still living in Moose Jaw, to the house to hang out and just visit. And this is a bunch of guys, so let's not picture a turkey dinner with all the trimmings. It would just been like beer, wings, and Call of Duty, probably. Now, according to Colin, Dylan had told him that Cameron was going to come up for the weekend, and Colin had, for some reason, said no, he didn't want him to come. So on October 10th, 2008, which was the Friday, Colin was out at a bar drinking with another friend that night, and Nick, who was home, saw that Cameron had come over and apparently overheard Cameron and Dylan talking that when Colin got home, they were going to kick Colin's ass. So Nick texted Colin to let him know. So Colin came home, and by this time, everybody had been drinking. There was Colin, Nick, Nick's girlfriend, who's not named, Cameron and Dylan, who were all there at that time. And according to all of them, except Dylan, who no one's been able to find to ask, a physical fight broke out between Colin and Dylan with pushing and shoving. Colin describes it as a fight wrestling match, and Nick says that they, quote, went at it, pushing each other around, they made it to the floor, and Dylan's been throwing punches, and Colin looked like he was going more to restrain Dylan rather than hurt him. And this fight moved at some point from inside the house to out in the front yard. Now, Nick says in part of his reporting of the events that he turned around to get a drink, and when I came back to see, Dylan had left and Colin said he went out the back. Now, according to all of the witnesses, Dylan leaving out the back was because during the fight, Colin had kicked him out of the house saying he didn't live there anymore. So basically, get out and come back for your stuff later. Cameron witnessed the fight and the parting words and Dylan walking out the back door. So he hurriedly grabbed his things and left out that same back door. And this was around 2 a.m. according to everyone. Cameron didn't run into Dylan when he left out the same door, which, remember, was the back, which led to the garage, the back fence, and then beyond that, that green space, which led to Calgary Trail or 34th Avenue, depending on which direction you went in. But at 3:30 a.m., Dylan's phone called Cameron's phone several times, like in a span of just a few minutes. But he didn't get any of those calls because he was calling 911 to tell them that he was hiding from Colin because he was worried he was going to beat him up as well. But two neighbors called 911 to report a disturbance in their front yard, and at least one of those two calls came in at 4 a.m. And one of them indicated that a man was being beaten by some other people, as in plural. But the police didn't come out just then, which is a little bit strange. I get that they wouldn't immediately respond to a disturbance from a neighbor, but you'd think they would have responded to Cameron's call, especially if they were all happening sort of at the same place. Anyways, by the time the police finally did show up, they didn't get any answer at the house and all was quiet there. Now, during this night, Erin and Dylan had been texting, and she had texted around 2 or so to say that she might come there that night after work, so leave the door unlocked for her. But at 3:30, when she called him, it just went to his voicemail, which, now, she didn't know any of this was going on, so she assumed that he had just went to bed. And at that same time, 3:30, when he was trying to call Cameron, he also sent a Facebook message to his brother Derek, asking what his number was, which is also a little bit strange that you wouldn't have your brother's number in your phone, but just as a Facebook contact. But there isn't really anything fishy about it mentioned anywhere, other than that knowing that the message came from Dylan's account and from his phone. Erin didn't go to the house that night, but she tried calling the house several times the next day, but no one was answering, and Dylan wasn't answering any of her texts. Colin finally picked up the phone later in the evening on the Saturday, and according to her, Colin just said that Dylan wasn't home and no, she couldn't come by to the house to get some of her things. Now, he likely did say something about kicking him out because I have a feeling that's why she asked if she could come and get her things that she'd left there, because she knew that he wasn't going to be living there anymore. But Erin didn't get a hold of Dylan, so she tried the hospitals and checking with police if he had maybe been arrested and came up with nothing. But by Tuesday, when the holiday weekend was officially over and Dylan didn't show up for work, Erin called Dylan's brother Derek. And finally, by Wednesday, they confessed to Mom, Melanie, that they hadn't been able to find Dylan and that he'd been kicked out of the Colin and Nick's place. He had left wearing only a t-shirt and jeans and skateboarding shoes. October 10th that year during the day had been about 0 degrees Celsius or 32 degrees Fahrenheit, but it dropped by the early morning hours to about minus 8 degrees or 17 degrees Fahrenheit with that wind chill. So a t-shirt and jeans would not be a good thing. Melanie called the Edmonton police and reported Dylan missing, but they wouldn't take the report because she was calling from Moose Jaw, which is in Saskatchewan, and he was missing in Edmonton, which is in Alberta. So he needed to be reported missing locally. So Melanie decided to call Colin and get him to report Dylan missing. And she was like, do it now, do it today, like right now. But according to police, they never did receive a call from Colin to report him missing.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
Melanie, believing that the report had been filed, hightailed it to Edmonton as any mom would and started to search with volunteers and other family members. I couldn't find anything about Melanie's reaction to learning that Colin had not done what she asked and reported Dylan missing, but they started a ground search with flyers and posters around the area. According to this missing person's report, at the time of his disappearance, Dylan was deaf in his right ear, and they knew that he had been in a physical fight that did involve apparently being knocked into a stove. So they were concerned that he had maybe wandered off dazed and because of his hearing might have been struck by a vehicle. But as I said in Lisa Marie Young's case, if you walk off after an argument and you get eaten by a bear or struck by a car, it tends to leave evidence of that behind. And suicides and hypothermia deaths usually result in the body being found rather quickly. But by the 1 week in, missing persons detectives Jim Gurney and Sean Jenkinsons were officially assigned to the case, and they organized a police search with dogs, but they didn't come up with any signs of Dylan other than finding his wallet in the next door neighbor's yard. He had neighbors on both sides, but it doesn't indicate which neighbor's yard it was found in. So we know that he probably did leave the house, as Colin, Nick, Nick's girlfriend, and Cameron all say that he did. But wearing a t-shirt, jeans, sneakers, and now without any money, but he apparently did have his phone on him. But all activity on his phone stopped just after 3:30 a.m. on October 11th, 2008. The official police search was called off shortly after because it was getting really expensive and they really didn't have anything to go on. Like, they didn't even know which direction he'd walked off in. They figured he had wandered off drunk and without proper clothing and was likely dead now from exposure, which I could agree with, but it's not like they had to look miles and miles for the house for him. He wasn't in a car, and based on how he was dressed, frostbite at 17 degrees Fahrenheit or minus 8 degrees Celsius would probably set in about 30 minutes. Now, if he made it to Calgary Trail, he likely would have headed to either the Denny's or the 7-Eleven, which are open 24 hours. But there's no indication that he did that, and or that he was seen by any passing motorists along either of those roads. This was a really big case in Edmonton at the time, so his name and description were all over the place. And at that time of night and year, seeing a guy walking along the road would have been something that you would have taken notice of. And the police search did include a helicopter search as well as with dogs. There is a possibility that he hitchhiked. Dylan's aunt Peggy understood that Dylan liked being in Edmonton but was finding it too big of a city, and with the issues with his roommates, was kind of considering moving home again. He was only 21, and although he was happy with Aaron, 21 isn't exactly heavy commitment age for guys a lot of times, so there is a possibility that he just said screw it and decided to make his way home. But he had a really good job, and you'd think he would try to call someone to let them know or would have returned to the area to look for his wallet. Hitchhiking is dangerous as well, as we all hopefully know. Serial killers are real and sex trafficking is a thing. But what about the cousins, you ask? Well, only one person in the family really has any doubts about Colin and Nick, and that is Dylan's Aunt Gaylene. She didn't understand why Colin had not reported Dylan missing, especially after getting explicit instructions from Melanie to do it. And why had Colin kept his skydiving appointment after, rather than help in the search for him? After all, he must have felt terrible that after arguing with him and kicking him out that very night, something awful must have happened to him. And when the family was being interviewed at the time of their initial investigation, Colin said that people go missing all the time and bodies get dumped in construction sites, which is kind of an odd thing to say at such a terrible time when no one was suggesting that he'd been murdered at that time yet. She also had found bloody paper towels in the house, but that was passed off as, well, there was a fight and things got messy. But I couldn't find any information on anyone's specific injuries. It was referred to as blood-soaked roll of paper towels, which sounds very ominous, but it could have just been some wadded-up bits with blood on it from dabbing on a cut. It's impossible to know which without access to the police records. But no one else in the family, not Dylan's mom Melanie, or dad Dan, or brother Derek, his sister Tara, and of course no one in Colin or Nick's family. I have no idea which aunt is Cameron's mom, but even Cameron doesn't suspect that Colin had anything to do with his disappearance. Cameron saw him walking out, according to him, and their story is all the same. They all admit at there being a fight, and they all agree that he walked out of the house on his own, and he was alive when he left. But by 2016, the Edmonton police moved Dylan's file for missing persons to homicide. Melanie wasn't really clear on why they had made that sudden decision at the time. She said that they didn't have any new information to go off that she knew of, but she did feel that this case should have been treated as a homicide a lot earlier, saying to the CBC, Dylan just didn't wander off and freeze to death, even though he was consuming alcohol. We knew there was something more to it. It's very hard to live knowing that someone you love is gone and there's no closure. And the family didn't even learn of this decision until the Fifth Estate did an episode on Dylan's case, and they learned from Staff Sergeant Bill Clark that, reviewing the whole file, reviewing the circumstances of the night that he went missing, it stinks, frankly. There is a strong suspicion that it's a homicide, and I think we need to take it on. And after the airing of this Fifth Estate episode, which included Staff Sergeant Bill Clark stating that he believed that there were people that had lied to the police and the family, he claimed that if a person just wanders off or goes missing, we usually find them. There's been various stories about that. You know, you get hit by a car, you wander off, you're going to be found somewhere. It just doesn't make sense. I think we need to get to the bottom of it. We need to really find out what happened to Dylan and bring closure to this family. He says, based on all of the information around the events of his disappearance, it strongly stinks like a homicide to him. He believes that Dylan was killed the night that he went missing. He says, can I prove it yet? No. Will I prove it? I hope so. I do believe we will. Now, he didn't come out and say it was Colin, but it was pretty implied that there was a family connection to Dylan's disappearance. He hopes that someone's conscience gets the better of them, and in reality, if it was the result of manslaughter, there were four witnesses that also have helped keep quiet about it. One person taking something to their grave is possible. I mean, look at O.J. Simpson. But four people, someone is bound to talk to someone at some point. Staff Sergeant Dwayne Hunter told the media that a hotline had been set up and said someone needs to come forward with the information they know that at least one person has out there, and also revealed this public attention has helped us. It's brought new information which has helped us further our investigation, and it's also resulting in us revisiting previous investigative tasks and actually re-interviewing other people. But when shown the footage of Bill Clark's statements, it didn't change any of the family members' minds that it might have been the result of something done to Dylan. Melanie said, it hurts because I don't want it to be any relative that could harm another person. I want to find Dylan. Now, Gaylene may have had her doubts, but no one else seemed to. His sister Tara doesn't buy it. She feels bad that Colin's being doubted, and it's been hard on him because he was the last person to see him and things were very heated for them. Derek told the Fifth Estate that he can say with 100% guarantee that he doesn't blame Colin and Nick. And Colin and Nick have actually attended some of the annual vigils that the family holds in Edmonton each Thanksgiving weekend. But they have both not spoken publicly, like, ever. By Thanksgiving of 2023, Dylan's case was moved to the cold case unit and is no longer actively being investigated because they need a tip, basically, before they could move forward with anything. The family is still offering a $40,000 reward for information, and Melanie says no one ever wants to relive or rehash what we went through, but it's a reality for our family that won't go away until we get answers. Now, as for me, I do not like to point fingers, but I don't think Dylan got very far that night. In fact, he might not have made it past that front yard. I have covered a couple of single punch deaths, and it doesn't really take much to die in a fist fight, actually. One wrong punch or fall to the ground and it's kind of over. However, there doesn't appear to be any evidence of getting rid of a body, other than no one answering the door when the police finally showed up. No burning barrels or nothing that maybe got missed. The neighbors that called 911, I'm interested in hearing exactly what they saw and heard that night. And I'm interested in Cameron. I think if anyone was going to break, it would be him. Unintentional killings, like in a fight, tend to be kind of messy because you aren't prepared for them. So there is usually a lot of cleanup. And if you aren't prepared, I'd think you'd maybe miss something. Like, was there blood on the paper towels? Was that ever tested? Was that even true? Was the house ever searched? There's just too many unanswered questions. And why the sudden move from missing persons to homicide in 2016? The police know more about what happened. I think they just can't prove it, at least enough for a conviction. I think there's really no point in getting into a lot of theories because, as in so many unsolved cases, there's information that none of us have access to. I can't exactly call up the Edmonton police and ask them for all the files because it is still technically an open case. So if you have any information about Dylan's disappearance, you were in the Edmonton area at the time of October 11th, 2008, maybe saw a man walking with wearing just a t-shirt along Calgary Trail at 4 in the morning, that would be very good information to pass on to the Edmonton police. And with that, I will hopefully be back with another episode next week. I'm actually working on an episodic series for you that I'm very excited about, and I hope that you're going to enjoy as well. In the meantime, just relax, don't stress. It's all going to be fine. Everything is fine. And as always, thank you so much for listening.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price.
This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.